Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show.
720 WGN.
611, Pete McMurray in for Steve Cochran. It is the Cubs home opener today. We're all going to be cracking a beer at 7 o'clock. Is that right?
It works.
God, it's good to be back with you guys.
Welcome back.
I feel like Ennett's got a little bit of an edge today. I like it.
Well, no, I was in a great mood, Pete. As you know, when I walked into the studio, I saw you.
Yes.
Nice chat. And then Andrea brings up the whole comedy bit thing about making me the subject of her scorn.
Right.
Oh,
I just don't get
you
it.
Really? Come on. You're one of my best friends in the world.
Oh, really? You guys are best friends now, hanging out on the weekends? Is
that how you treat your best friend?
I said one of.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm kidding.
Oh,
come on.
Qualifier.
You know I love you, Dave.
How long have you two known each other and worked together?
I've been here almost 20 years in November. 20 years in November, and Dave Ennett was the very first person who ever introduced me on this radio station.
Do you know how I did that?
Yes, I do. You want to tell?
What did you say?
I'm sure he said the name wrong.
Say what you said.
Okay, so we're doing a Three Bears remote out in Aurora at the casino.
It was November 8th of 1997.
And so our producer, Dan Filato, didn't believe in penmanship, apparently. And he scribbles this note, hands it to me, who's doing the news, and it said, what did I call you? Was it Angela?
Angela, yeah.
I went with the Mr. T pronunciation.
Right.
Angela Darlis with the news.
Nice.
And I went, oh, it's the great Dave Ennett. That's fantastic. I listened to you when I was little. That's awesome. No.
Best friends ever since.
Here we go.
All right. Time for the six at six. Let's roll it.
The Steve Cochran Show presents the top six at six.
That's the best number I've heard yet.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yes.
Six.
Lucky guess.
My favorite number is six.
Top six at six on 720 WGN.
All right, top six at six. Rex Tillerson is taking a hard line with Russia. He was on Face the Nation yesterday. He says it was incompetent of the country for having allowed Syria to hold on the chemical weapons. He's in Moscow this week. What's going to happen?
I think it's a lot's going to be saving face. It'll be very interesting, though, because, again, he's going to be with six other group of seven foreign ministers, and they're going to try and send a very clear message to Russia. Don't support the Bashar Assad regime in Syria. Just don't do it. It's not going to be good. I think
the Russians are not going to back down. Nothing's going to happen this week.
We're going to see a hard ass Rex Tillerson, more so than I think we normally would. But very interesting to see, and the timing couldn't be crazier. It was weird watching that last night. You and I were texting.
Right.
It was just reading kind of what was going on.
Well, his opening statement on Face the Nation yesterday, he was reading a statement, which I thought was odd.
I thought that was a bit odd, too.
And then he answered off the cuff the other questions. But he was prepared for that first one. Top six at six. Number two, the U.S. has reduced airstrikes against Islamic State militants in the country as it waits to see how the Syrian government and Russia respond.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're sitting back and seeing what's going to happen.
It's going to be interesting to see what Egypt does, too, because they had kind of an awkward reset with Washington, with President Trump over the weekend, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, 58 of the 59 missile strikes were successful. They've backed off a little bit. But honestly, Pete, I would see maybe more strikes.
What's our game plan here? Do we even know?
Are they making it up
as they go along?
I don't think we know. I think right now President Trump's being very proactive, which I think is has a lot of support from the American people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Number three, Judge Neil Gorsuch is scheduled to be sworn in today. Okay.
Yeah, there was a private ceremony yesterday. There'll be a public one today as well with President Trump. So it'll be interesting. Neil Gorsuch going to take his seat as the 9th U.S. Supreme Court justice, finally, because the court's been vacant for almost a year. Rather, it's been deadlocked.
Deadlocked.
Yeah. Just eight.
Sergio Garcia wins his first major. 0 for 73. Now he's 1 for 74.
Yep. He tried more than any current player to win a major, finally gets it, and it really dramatically, too. I mean, it was a very compelling tournament to watch, and you had some guys who, starting the day, you thought, okay, this guy's going to win, whether it was Jordan Spieth, whether it was Ricky Fowler, but the two guys who were tied after three rounds ended up tied after four rounds.
Right.
And then Sergio wins in the playoff.
Is there anything better than Masters Sunday? Because I feel like that's all everyone's talking about. And you're in front of the TV, or you have the TV on in the background the entire day.
Yeah. I mean, it was great. It's when it plays out the way it did, it was tremendous theater. Now, I've always been partial to, I enjoy the U.S. Open. It's Father's Day, and there usually are some great finishes there, too.
Right. Okay.
Thunderstorms on the way in the Chicago area. Is it really going to rain today? I think the rain's going to stop, of course, by game time tonight for the Cubs home opener. But is it going to rain downtown?
Supposedly, we're supposed to have showers moving in. I saw a little bit of a lightning storm, lightning show over the lake this morning. But supposed to be storms this afternoon, 2, 3 o'clock. It's not supposed to be severe. We can check in with Tim McGill a little bit later on, too. But scattered showers starting about 2, 3 o'clock, and that'll continue through the evening hours as well. Hopefully, we'll get a break for the game.
Yes. And finally, the top 6 of 6, Victoria Beckham, her line has been dropped from Target. I know it's very, very sad. And the items, they are what? Say that again, Mary. Come on in.
Oh, I'm sorry. It dropped at Target, as in it was the first day at Target.
I was just going to say, didn't it just start?
Oh. People were lined up everywhere.
Why is she so popular? I just don't understand her.
No, she doesn't even smile.
Do you know
she's
anytime,
perfect.
What was the
she
other?
Is not.
What was the other clothing line that Target had? Lily something?
Pulitzer, yeah.
That's it. And, yeah. And the first time they had
who?
That, people were like,
I don't even know who that is.
They were ransacking the stores just to get this line.
Yeah,
so.
And what everyone does is they get in line early, they buy the stuff, and then they sell it. It's already being sold like on eBay and things
who
for
has
four
time
times.
For that?
We should buy something. We should go on eBay and buy something. Victoria Beckham.
It's kind of cute, her stuff.
It
actually.
Is cute.
She, but yeah, is she popular?
Yes.
She is.
When?
Well.
Since when?
Yeah, what has she done lately?
Spice Girls.
Nothing.
Have kids and
the Spice Girls
smile.
Broke up years ago
she
and then they got back
clothes,
together.
And she dresses really well.
Hey, she okay. snarls with the best
her
of them.
She never smiles. Remember, she had bad teeth for a year,
yeah,
so she didn't smile, and then she got them fixed
there's
and still doesn't smile.
There's actually a picture of her that with the link Mary included, and she's got a little bit of a smirk.
Come on.
Yeah.
Do you see any
no,
white?
No, look. Come on. That's a... I wouldn't call it a smile, but...
When I look at David Beckham, it's like I'm looking into a mirror. What's so funny?
What? It's funny.
Pete, I get it.
Yeah,
but they're just ridiculing
okay.
it.
All right. Let's take a look at traffic. Mary, save me. ...623, Pete McMurray in for Steve Cochran. Bombs exploded at two churches in different cities in northern Egypt as churchgoers were celebrating Palm Sunday. Sunday, 43 people dead, 100 wounded. Joining us from ABC News, it's Tom Rivers. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, sadly, the death toll has gotten even larger. 44 now, the official number, dead and over 100, as you say, injured. Some of those in pretty serious shape. But funerals for some of them today, security, as you can well imagine, already high in Egypt, stepped up even more. And guess what's on the horizon? The Pope's got a visit coming up in just a couple of weeks.
Now, is that still on, the Pope visiting?
At this stage of the game, it is on. I'm sure they're going over the schedule with a fine-tooth comb. If any of the venues pose any unique security problems, I'm sure that will be amended and changed. But at this stage of the game, that trip is going ahead.
Tom, you had Sweden on Friday. You had London in March.
Oh, Lordy, yeah.
Two in Egypt. Is there a trend or connection, or is it just random acts?
It seems like it's random, but it is ramping up, isn't it? We had this week Syria. We had St. Petersburg. We had Sweden. We had London. It makes your head spin. But, again, ISIS was quick off the mark on this particular situation to claim responsibility. They actually named the names, said they were two suicide bombers involved in this. And they're going after more soft civilian targets with, you know, looking at the calendar and the symbolic importance to the Christian community of Palm Sunday, doing that because they simply can't go after military and security targets and with any chance of a success at this stage of the game. So they're going after these soft targets. And people are shaking their heads. What can you do? Because security can never be 100%.
Tom, members of the G7 are meeting in Italy. They originally were going to talk about the chemical attack in Syria, but now right. I'm sure Sweden and Egypt are going to be atop that agenda. What do you expect to see? And what do you think Russia's role, or response, I guess I should say, is going to be to what they ask them to do?
Yeah, I think at this stage they're going to have a unified statement, at least saying, Mr. Tillerson, when you go to Moscow, you've got the support of all of us. And I think that he's going to get in Sergei Lavrov a stiff arm, saying, no, it's not a situation that's up for debate. We still, believe what the Syrian narrative is, and the fact that it's very, very diametrically opposed to the U.S., if you will, form of events. And they're going to just say, well, say what you have to say. And goodbye. Have a nice trip. I can't see any meeting of the minds at this stage.
No, and Rex Tillerson, it's his first G7 meeting as Secretary of State. That'll be interesting. I'm just curious, do you see the United States or coalition forces going in and removing Assad?
No, not at this stage. Not 6.5 years of grinding war. In fact, you know, if you flip the coin and say if, because it's a proxy war, the Saudis have been throwing money at various rebel factions over the years. The U.S. had their influence there. Iran's had their influence there. Fill in the blank. Turkey as well. If everybody had not done that, this would have been quelled by Assad very, very quickly. You've been looking at a very different situation. A lot of people would have had their lives. A lot of people would not be refugees right now. But by the actions of a lot of countries, including the U.S., it has prolonged the misery in that country.
Tom Rivers, ABC News. Thank you, Tom.
Take care.
Okay, it is 6:27. Let's find out if it's going to actually rain today downtown. Tim McGill. Tim, how you doing? Good morning.
Good. How are you guys doing?
Good, man. Is it going to rain downtown for the home opener today?
Probably. I think
I mean, can't get a straight answer from anybody.
Well, we're going to have some storms this morning, although a lot of these are diminishing, and then a better chance, I think, between around 3 o'clock this afternoon, say about 8 o'clock tonight. It'll be scattered, so it's not a done deal. And if it does rain, it'll be a quick downpour. It won't be enough to cancel a game or anything like that. But you might have a delay or two.
Okay.
And the storms that do pop up, I need to mention, they could be strong, even severe. We're in the slight risk category for some severe weather today with maybe some hail, some damaging winds. We had hail with some of the storms this morning in St. Charles, Sleepy Hollow area. So there's a possibility of that. But again, anything that forms is going to be quick moving and kind of scattered. So it's not going to be a big washout or anything
like
that.
It's okay because remember last time it rained, what happened for us?
Did we win?
Okay.
Did we win?
We won a little old thing called the World
Series. Yeah, that's delay.
A little rain delay. That's okay. We don't mind that.
Tim, how is this going to affect me drinking at Bernie's today?
It shouldn't affect you at all. You should be fine. That's the most important thing.
All right. Just wanted to make sure. Okay, so it could rain. We don't know. But if it does, it'll be very quick.
It'll be quick moving, a couple heavy downpours maybe, then out of here. The good news is, I think, is the wind will be blowing out for the start of the game. Gusty southwest winds. So we could see anything hit up high could be carried out by some strong winds. And then I think the winds late in the game might push back on shore off the lake, so we might get a wind coming back in later on in the game. But for most of the game, wind blowing out, it'll be about 66, 67 for the start of the game. Pretty
Schwarber.
Mild for a Cubs opener.
There you go, Ennett. He's going to be hitting some dingers tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Wind I think with out. Or without the wind, he's hitting
it. Man, it's windy right now.
Yeah, it is.
This wind has been crazy the last
Big
week or
time.
So.
He could hit one in a hurricane. It doesn't matter.
Is the Schwarber ball still up on the...
No.
They took it down.
They took it down. Okay.
Where is it? Do we know?
I've got it.
That's where it is.
Thank you, Tim.
Sure, no problem.
All right, it's 720 WGN.
I have edema on my thigh, pink stuff in my eye, and I need you now. I've got a stomach pain that's low, fungus on my toe, and I need you now.
640, Dr. Kevin Most is brought to you by Northwestern Medicine, making people better by making medicine better. It's Doc Most on the phone. Doc, the group here had genetic testing done last week. I heard you guys talking about that. Mm-hmm. And do most people need to do this, Doc?
Well, Pete, it's interesting. It depends on what you want it for. So I heard that they teed it up, but I unfortunately had to work and could not listen to the segment. But you know, when you
were growing
up,
we'll send you the link, Doc. It was a doozy.
Oh, it was.
Well, Pete, when you're growing up, you know, when I was growing up, people say, you know, well, what's your nationality? I said, well, I'm half Irish and I'm a quarter German and a quarter French. My mom's Irish. My dad was French and German.
Right.
And that's how you just kind of grew up, right? You talked like that. Now, with this testing that they had done, you know, we go back thousands of years instead of going back a generation or two. So from the novelty side of it, it's very interesting for discussion as far as your ancestry. I think what's going to be really cool is what happens as we move forward and how we start using this in medical in the medical world.
Yeah, how is that going to work? Because if you know your genetics, of course, you're going to know if you're predisposed to different diseases. But is that going to help us down the road? I'm sure it will.
Absolutely. You know, if I don't want to say medical geeks, but there was a study that is still going on right now that started in Massachusetts in a town called Framingham, where they convinced, and this is 1950s, they convinced 5,000 people. They said, you know what, we don't know enough about heart disease. We want to study this group of you about heart disease. We want to see what you eat. We want to see how your heart works. We want to see what your lifestyle changes can do. And we know more about heart disease because of these individuals from Framingham, Massachusetts. And now the study's in its third generation. Same thing needs to happen with genetics. We need people that are going to have to step forward and say, you know what? Big brother's not watching me. Here, you can have some of my genes. Here's my history. And then we watch out and we see, because the implications of genetics and knowing what we know about people will make personalized medicine so much better for generations to come.
Doc, I know there's a few tests that are out there to show if you, I guess, are predisposed to some of these, to some cancers. I know, though, others are not, like ovarian cancer and the like. Will there eventually be a test where you can find out almost definitively, yes, I am more likely to get whatever it might be, say cancer, MS, whatever the disease might be, as opposed to somebody else or somebody else in my family?
Yeah. Andrea, I think we're at the tip of the iceberg for this. I think people will look back, I don't know whether it's going to be 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, and just laugh at what we know now and say, oh my gosh, that's what you guys were working with. So we do know some things right now, and there's two very distinct things we need to talk about here. One is the diagnostic testing. That's kind of what you were talking about, the BRCA gene, we'll say, the BRCA gene,
right,
which is one that we know about a lot about for breast cancer and ovarian. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the ones that you guys are doing, the 23andMe, where I can say, if you take this test, I can look at it and say, you have a higher chance for Alzheimer's, you have a higher chance for celiac. Not a diagnostic test, but kind of the odds play of saying you have a higher chance of this.
Well, Doc, if you have, I have a very close family, so we have a family tree, so I can look back and say, okay, my grandfather had heart disease, he died of a heart attack. One of my uncles had heart disease, he died of a heart attack. I have three siblings that have had cancer under 50, so I just assume that I'm predisposed to cancer and heart disease.
Correct. So a lot of what we're looking at, Pete, is exactly what you're talking about. We were, I won't say we were terrible in the past as about collecting data, but we were not so good. And a lot of it was on paper, right? So you said, I had a great-grandfather who died of heart disease, or I had a heart attack. Or died of cancer. Well, now with the information we have not only do we know what you died from, we know where you worked, we know what you did, we know where you lived, we know a lot of more data about you. But for some of the more simple things, yeah, I can tell you my father died at the age of 61 from a heart attack. My brother had a heart attack at 47. Do you think that I'm concerned about heart disease in my family? Absolutely. So knowing that information up front allows you to make lifestyle changes to minimize the impact of diseases that you may have a possibility of ending up with.
Every Monday, Dr. Kevin Most joins us at this time. Doc, hold on a second. I'm going to ask you about stem cells when we come back, and should we all go out and get genetic testing, okay?
Yep, you got it.
650, Pete McMurray in for Steve Cochran. On the phone with us, he's powered by Northwestern Medicine, making people better by making medicine better. It's Dr. Kevin Most. Doc, I want to talk about, should we all go out and get genetic testing? Everyone on the show got it except Dave Bennett, by the way. Why didn't Dave get it?
I think because I was away.
You were
okay,
away.
You were gone.
Yeah.
Okay. Andrea, what did you find out?
I found
were
out
you shocked about anything?
Not really. I was 100% basically Eastern European, so there was a mixture of Greek and a little bit of Italian, which I didn't know about, but it's all Greek to me. Then they broke down these little, I guess, what were the side reports called, Mary? These forums
or whatnot. Variants or whatever,
yeah.
The Neanderthal reports.
There were these variants, yeah, and it kind of tells
Neanderthal
you,
reports?
Yeah, yes. If you pay a little extra, it tells you, if you are more likely to
have back hair.
Have hair on your back.
Why are we bringing that up?
Or if you, I know, right? Uh-huh. Hello, Mr. Back Hair.
No. Just to clarify, Steve gave all the women on the show it for Christmas.
Yeah, he was trying to. I think he thought it would help him figure out
understand
our psyche.
Yeah, because he said he doesn't understand the other side. So that's why we all.
That's the human race. Men will never understand women.
But then, of course, he had it done on himself.
Well, because he had. He couldn't have left.
They wanted to find out.
And actually, his genetic, his Neanderthal trait was that he had the muscles of a sprinter.
Yes, which is very funny
because he's the slowest person.
Exactly, if you walk with him or something.
He was the athlete of the group.
Well, maybe he was fast back in the day when he had good knees.
There was another one too. It said if you are more likely to sneeze after you eat dark chocolate.
Yeah, and all the girls.
Oh yes, I remember hearing that.
And I don't think any of us have that trait.
Doc, should we go out and get the genetic testing?
Yes, I'm sorry I missed that conversation. The individual on that, you guys have fun. This is my personal opinion. My personal opinion is yes. And now you can get more than what they got. You know, they got the ancestry essentially a portion of it, and now, but you can get to see what your risks are of having certain diseases. Now, some people say I don't want to know, and that's fine. It's totally voluntary. But if I could tell you that collecting enough data is going to allow us to, in the future, tell somebody what antidepressant they should take, what chemotherapy they should take. The data is out there. We just need to collect it all and put it into the right format. So my personal opinion is, yes, go out and get it. One, the ancestry thing is fun for parties you can talk about. And two, if you find out that you have a higher chance of something, okay, start monitoring for it earlier. The earlier we find diseases, the easier it is for us to correct them.
The statement, I don't want to know, is a cop-out. I think people are scared. I think information is power, especially in my family where heart disease and cancer runs rampant. I think you need to know, right, Doc?
Absolutely. And to be honest with you, even if you don't want to know, let's think about generations to come. You know, let's think about your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren. Those are the ones that this is going to make an impact on. And there's going to be a huge study that's starting very soon here. And matter of fact, Chicago will be one of the collection sites that we're going to try to collect millions and millions and millions of people's DNA. Now, some people are saying that's big government and I don't want to do it, but it's actually medical research that really is going to make an impact in the future.
What about saving umbilical cords for stem cells when babies are born? Are they still doing that? I know that was a big thing when Charlie was born 11 years ago.
Yeah, you know, it is kind of interesting. There's a lot of controversy, obviously, about stem cells and what are we going to do with them and how we're going to use them. And just for people who don't understand, stem cells are essentially a cell that can be teased into doing anything. So we'll take heart disease, for example. For heart attacks, when you have a heart attack and a portion of your heart dies because it didn't get enough blood, it got blocked, that essentially is there forever. It'll scar down, but there's no way to regenerate that tissue in the heart. So we have to learn how to do things differently. Fast forward to what might happen with stem cells is that we could potentially now build more heart cells out of these stem cells so that the regeneration of heart disease of the heart is better. So stem cells are kind of interesting, and I think that they're going to play more and more of a future as they're allowed to. But right now, it's very restricted.
I had calf surgery. They had to extend one of my tendons in my right calf, and the doctor took stem cells out of my hip and injected them into my heel. And
Correct.
It was only the second time that he's done it, and when I went back in 6 weeks later, I had zero pain in my heel, and that's where all the pain was. And he said, oh, my God, it worked.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So there's two kinds of stem cells. Well, there's more than two, but two basic ones. One is the embryonic, the baby ones. And then one is, as adults, we have stem cells. We have stem cells in our body that allow us to regenerate things, red blood cells, other tissues, skin. So it's the magic of what those cells can do and how we can train them or teach them to be what we want them to be instead of what the body's telling them to be.
Are those stem cell transplants painful, or is that procedure in that process getting a little easier, Doc?
Well, yeah, and it's kind of, to be honest with you, it's kind of hit and miss. I mean, we have cells all over our body, so how do we look under, and say, okay, this one's a stem cell and this one is not? So that's where the science is right now, is to try to tease these things out, to try to identify, how do we identify stem cells faster and with more accuracy so that we can use them in a way that is going to help us regenerate or repair? Because that's what stem cells do. They repair damage in our body. And if anything that we can do, that we can use our own body instead of medications or other treatments, I think is good.
They put me out for surgery, and when I woke up, I was in more pain in my hip from them taking the stem cells out than I was in my foot and my calf.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. You know, people
it hurts.
Have bone, yeah, that people have bone marrow for leukemias, you know, that hurts. And other people, when they go into surgery, you have to realize that, you know, you're put sometimes into a position, your body's put into a position that makes it easier for the surgeon to do his job, but it's not a position that you would sit in for 2-3 hours directly. So sometimes it's like, wow, my surgery was on this part of my body, but this other part of my body hurts. And it's, well, we had to turn you and hold you in this position for 3 hours, and your body didn't like that. But don't worry, that's going to go away. We've corrected the other problem.
It's just crazy. So, yes, go out and get genetic testing.
Yeah, I would say yes, go out and get it. And you know what? If people say, hey, you know what? I don't want to do it right now. Just wait. This is, like I said, this is exploding with growth right now. So you're going to start to see, well, right now you can go out and find out about maybe 10, 12 different diseases. And you say, well, none of those interest me. Just wait. You wait 3 years, 5 years. That list is going to continue to grow every year. And we're going to get to know more and more about our body and our genetics and the importance of what we can do. Knowing your genetic makeup is going to make people's lives better in the future.
Dr. Kevin Most. Doc Most, great to talk to you, man. Have a great week.
Pete, take care. We'll talk to you guys soon.
All right. See you, man. It's 720 WGN.
Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
It is 7:12. Pete McMurray in for Steve Cochran. If you follow CNN's Ryan Nobles on Twitter, you can retweet stuff like this, like I did yesterday. POTUS was at a golf course for the 16th time in his presidency. At this stage, President Obama had yet to play one round.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty interesting. On the phone with us from CNN, Ryan Nobles. How you doing, man?
Great, Pete. I always love the promotion of my Twitter feed. The more social media followers, the better, right?
Well, think about that stat that you threw out there yesterday. 16 times. It's not even 100 days in.
Yeah, and I think the thing that I really don't care how much the president golfs personally. I didn't care how much President Obama golfs or how much President Bush golfs. But the reason that I continue to point it out on social media is because President Trump was so relentless mm-hmm. in his attacks on President Obama when he was in office. In fact, his hypocrisy on this issue is so easy to point out. In fact, many people were retweeting a tweet that he put up during the Obama administration, when he specifically crushed President Obama for golfing while the problem in Syria was deteriorating. So here he had just launched an attack on Syria, and then he spent both Saturday and Sunday on the golf course. So, you know, this is just one example of, Donald Trump being very critical of something that President Obama did, and then turn around and do the exact same thing. So that's one of the reasons I think it's worth pointing out. The other reason I think it's worth pointing out is that his staff is not really that forthcoming with what he actually does at the golf course. So he'll leave and go to one of his Trump-owned properties to play golf, and they won't say why he's there. They'll say he's there for meetings. But then you see on social media not long after that there's pictures of him with people golfing.
Yep.
We actually have Ken Toohey, who's one of our cracked photojournalists for CNN. He actually has found spots along the Trump National Golf Course in Florida where he can actually peek in and see him on the golf course. That's the only way we even know definitively that he's golfing a lot of times. And, you know, you don't think it's that important, but this, you know, the American people need to know what their president is up to at all times.
When you're the president of the United States, you're a target. All eyes are on you. And if you're spending every other weekend at Mar-a-Lago and you're golfing, it's all about optics, especially right after you bomb Syria. You need to be at the White House. People want to see you at the White House.
Well, and it's not just that, Pete. You also have to keep in mind that he is spending every weekend at a Trump-owned property. And there are a lot of concerns about conflict of interest. There's a lot of concerns about how entangled he may still be with his businesses, even though he has said that he separated himself. And every time we report that he's at a Trump-owned property, that is effectively a promotional tool for these various resorts and golf courses that he has around the country and around the world. So every single time he does that, that gives the Trump National Golf Course, there's one up here in Washington, D.C., in Sterling, Virginia, that he goes to on a pretty regular basis, that promotes that golf course. we're talking about it right now. So,
yeah. Yep,
exactly,
you know,
right.
That's another question that people are, you know, raising about his frequent trips to these different places.
Ryan, let's switch to the G7. I know initially the leaders, the foreign ministers from the group of seven industrialized nations were going to meet to talk about Syria, but now I know Sweden and Egypt are sure to be atop that agenda. Rex Tillerson's first meeting of the G7 foreign ministers, what can we expect to see from him, and how much pressure do you see the United States and our allies putting on Russia with regard to Syria?
Well, there certainly seems to be a different posture from this administration as it relates to Russia just in the last week. You know, obviously the president was moved by what he saw with those pictures of the people being attacked in Syria, that chemical attack, and that's what led him to launch the United States attack on Syria. But, you know, the question is, you know, how swayed can Russia really be? I mean, for pretty much everyone in that region, particularly in Europe, where a lot of the G7 countries are from, have been unhappy with the Assad regime for some time, and it hasn't really moved Russia at all to do anything. You know, the question is, now that the fact that the United States has been willing to actually launch an attack, does that maybe wake Russia up a little bit and realize that the U.S. is serious about this? The question is, how effective a messenger can Rex Tillerson be? He's really been in the background of the Trump, the early days of the Trump administration. And of course, when he was the CEO of ExxonMobil, was pretty friendly with Russia. But he's talked pretty tough about Russia. Nikki Haley's talked pretty tough about Russia. And now the president is talking tough about Syria. You know, the big way you're going to convince Russia to do something about Syria is to kind of have some sort of coalition of economic sanctions that, you know, really hurt Vladimir Putin in the pocketbook. And maybe that compels him to do something. But the idea, I don't know if they get to the point where they all kind of come together and decide that some sort of military action is going to have to take place. I don't know if the appetite for that currently exists. But there's no doubt, Andrea, to your point, that these meetings are going to play a pretty important role in whatever the next U.S. move is in that region.
Right. And you don't see the United States going in and removing Bashar Assad from power?
I don't, but I mean, I think there's a lack of clarity when it comes to exactly what the United States position is when it comes to Assad in power. You had Tillerson on one Sunday morning show say that they don't want Assad in power, but they are hoping for a political removal of him so that the people of Syria stand up and say, we don't want him to be our leader anymore. But then you had Nikki Haley say that there's no possible way that there can be a political solution to what's happening in Syria because Assad has such a brutal regime there. He's not going to allow for political dissent. So, you know, kind of across the board, you know, leaders in the executive branch have said consistently that Assad needs to be out. The way you get him out, that seems to be unclear. And I was in a briefing with Mitch McConnell, the Senate majority leader, on Friday on Capitol Hill, and I personally asked him directly, you know, do you believe the U.S. policy is now for regime change in Syria? And he kind of danced around a little bit, but he also said that he can't see a future without Assad in power. But where they all seem to stop a little bit short is the United States, with, you know, men and women in American military uniforms going in and forcing the removal of Assad like we did in Iraq, because that becomes a much bigger problem than I think, you know, Americans maybe have an appetite for right now.
Ryan, I'm going to have you hold on. We're going to check traffic. We're going to talk more about that. Rex Tillerson on Face the Nation yesterday, he did have some key points that I want to bring up in just a second. But, Mayor, how is traffic now that it's raining downtown? CNN's Ryan Nobles on the phone with us. Ryan, do you want to tell everybody your Twitter handle?
Yep, it's Ryan Nobles with one N, so RyanNobles. It's the same thing on Instagram, too. I need more Instagram followers, so feel free to follow me there as well.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on Face the Nation yesterday. Russia supplies Syria with arms, weapons, planes, everything. Wouldn't they be involved in chemical weapons, too? He was asked the question yesterday, are you going to confront the Russians? Have you asked the Russians if they were involved? And he said, to his knowledge, they were not.
Right. And I think the broader point there, Pete, is that even if the Russians didn't necessarily know that the Assad regime still had chemical weapons and that they planned to use them, But regardless of what happened before, what happened after still demanded action, because the UN Security Council and Russia and the United States had an agreement that they, regardless of how you felt about Assad, that you didn't, no one wanted the use of chemical weapons, and that there were going to be consequences for using chemical weapons. So the fact that chemical weapons were used automatically should have forced Russia into a position where they agreed with the U.S. and right. the rest of the global community that something needed to be done. But what's kind of astounding about this is that the Russian government right now believes that it's actually the Syrian rebels who are responsible for the chemical attack, that they were hiding chemical weapons, and that during the bombing, those chemical weapons were exposed because the rebels were hiding them, which no one seems to agree with
right.
Other than Assad. And the idea that this, you know, kind of ragtag rebel army would have access to chemical weapons is a little bit laughable, because they're difficult to acquire. So I think what Tillerson's point was yesterday was that, you know, you can either not believe that Russia knew about the chemical weapons or not, but the fact that they were used should have forced Russia into action, and yet Russia refuses to address the situation of Assad and force some sort of repercussions for those actions.
I agree with you 100%. So what's going to happen this week when Tillerson goes to Moscow? What are they going to talk about? They're going to agree to disagree, and then he's going to come back home.
You know, the idea that some sort of grand bargain is going to be struck to solve this problem, I think is probably very slim chance of that happening. You know, Tillerson was originally supposed to meet with Putin himself, but then after this occurred, that they pulled that meeting back with Putin. So now he's only going to meet with the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. You know, I think that it's important to point out just kind of the dynamics of Syria and why it's so complicated there. It's not just about getting Assad out, right? So Assad is certainly a problem,
mm-hmm.
but this is where ISIS was born. So this civil war that cropped up after the Arab Spring was, you know, in the beginning, well-intentioned Syrian people who were sick of living under a brutal dictator. But then what happened was that radical extremists, Islamic extremists, took advantage of that situation, and that became ISIS. So now ISIS has a good slice of that section of Syria and a big section of Iraq as well, and that's kind of their foothold. So what Putin, and then you have the Putin connection and Putin and Assad being allies. And what Putin's argument is, and Assad's argument is, we're just fighting ISIS. We're trying to stop these terrorists from infecting the rest of the world. But yet, at the same time that they're doing that, they're hurting and killing their own people, including some well-intentioned Syrians who just want to live in a democracy. So there's really no easy solution to this problem. You can't just say, yes, we want Assad out, because that theoretically allows ISIS to explode.
Right.
You can't just say that you want to knock out ISIS with Assad's help, because then you're hurting these rebels. So, you know, the idea that, you know, this has been a festering problem now for several years, and the idea that they're going to come up with a solution here in the next couple of days seems impossible.
And I think we're also, Ryan, too, seeing President Trump laying the foundation for how he's going to fight ISIS, too, with his response to, or the administration's response to, the attacks in Sweden and Egypt over the weekend, too.
That's exactly right, Andrea. And, you know, Donald Trump said a lot about ISIS. You know, it's usually been very kind of hyperbolic over statements without any kind of substance, where he just says, we're going to crush ISIS, we're going to destroy them, that's going to be the end of it. But he has yet to lay out some sort of cogent plan for how that gets done. And they're making a lot of progress in Iraq. You know, they pushed them out of Mosul.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt that the caliphate is shrinking, but you do not solve the ISIS problem without solving the situation in Syria. So you can fix all you want in Iraq, but if you allow them to continue to have that foothold in Syria, then forget about it.
So many different layers. You got to eliminate ISIS. You got to stabilize the region, and then you have to think about, what are we going to do with Assad now? I mean, this
is. You know what's interesting too? The other interesting. I'm sorry to cut you off, Pete, but I was thinking about this last night, and how I spend my work week. Up until this point in the Trump presidency, we have barely touched on international issues. It has been a very domestic focused administration at this point. And, you know, dealing with health care, talking about all these executive orders that he's put in place. In one event has completely flipped the script in terms of his presidency, because not only are we now dealing with Syria, you also have the situation in North Korea. It's really now become a whole different conversation with the president. And to a certain extent, he has a blank script here.
Right.
He can now start over. And, you know, you can say what you want about the attack in Syria. He's been given a lot of credit for making that move. So can he forge these alliances that are necessary to solve some of these world problems, or does the problem become even bigger? It really, you know, the scope of his presidency has changed a lot here just in the last 7 days.
The bottom line is he needs a strategy. Ryan Nobles from CNN. Thanks for joining us, man. Have a great week.
My pleasure, guys. Have a good one.
All right. It's 720 WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
I know what he's thinking about a lot of these issues, and this is a good and decent man.
Rights is a superstar.
And as long as they do their job and we cooperate with them, they'll issue a report and the report will say there's nothing there.
He doesn't blame Paul Ryan. In fact, he thought Paul Ryan worked really hard. He enjoys his relationship with Paul Ryan, thinks that Paul Ryan's a great Speaker of the House.
I had a certain percentage of people that are voting that shouldn't be voting. There are estimates all over the map on that. And here's the problem. No one really knows.
Folks that shouldn't be in this country, they're going to be detained. And so apologize for nothing here.
742, Pete McMurray in for Steve Cochran. Our next guest is a journalist, a filmmaker, an Emmy Award-winning producer for 60 Minutes and ABC's Primetime. His new book is entitled The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. It's Chris Whipple. Chris, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Chris, the mayor of Chicago, a former chief of staff, a bull in a china shop. Is that how he's described in this book?
Well, you know, the very first chapter of the book is actually about this incredible day when 13 living White House chiefs, former chiefs, came to the White House as Rahm Emanuel was about to become chief to show him the keys to the men's room, as Dick Cheney put it. And the very first piece of advice was from Reagan's final chief, Ken Duberstein, who said, "Never forget that when you open your mouth, it's not you speaking, it's the President of the United States." To which Rahm said, "Oh, blank."
Oh. That's our mayor right there, man. That is so true. President Obama, a very nice man. Did he bring in Rahm because he needed to offset that niceness? He needed a guy that could just push people around?
You know, he really needed. Rahm was famous, as you know, on Capitol Hill for being a guy who would take the hill. No matter how many dead bodies were left in his wake, he got the job done. And I think that Obama came in at a time of crisis, on the verge of another Great Depression, the auto industry about to go belly up. He needed somebody who could do stuff fast. He needed somebody who could pass legislation on Capitol Hill. And I think Rahm did that for him.
Chris, the smooth transition of power, the peaceful transition of power, especially highlighted during this transition between President Obama and President Trump. Is that same, I guess, unknown factor still? Does that play amongst the gatekeepers as well, the chiefs of staff? Did they talk? Did they coordinate? Are they on friendly terms?
These guys are a really unique fraternity. I mean, there's nothing like it. And the gatekeepers, I try to tell the story of these 17 living guys who were, you know, they really are not only the president's closest confidant, but also the guys who make the difference between success and failure. I mean, from Watergate to Iran-Contra to the Iraq War to the rollout of Obamacare to the botched executive order on immigration under Trump and Priebus, that guy is often the only other person in the room. I mean, it's their influence. It's hard to exaggerate.
Let's go back to the 70s for a second. You had Alexander Haig, who served under Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. Then Rumsfeld came in and Dick Cheney. And you credit Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld for saving the Ford presidency. Is that right?
Well, talk about an untold story. I mean, Dick Cheney was, as Gerald Ford's 34-year-old White House chief, he was the most popular guy in town, believe it or not. He was self-effacing. He was the guy you wanted in the room when you needed to reach consensus. And a lot of chiefs have been saying ever since, what happened to that guy? Rumsfeld came in at a time when Jerry Ford was trying to govern with no real chain of command. He had five or six guys coming and going, and nobody was empowered as a chief. Sound familiar? It was a disaster after a month, and Ford then turned to Rumsfeld to organize his White House, exert discipline, control the message, and as a result, the Ford White House really turned around, and Ford almost caught Jimmy Carter in the election.
Chris Whipple on the phone with us. The book is called Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. How did Jimmy Carter start his presidency without a chief of staff? And it almost ruined him, didn't it?
Well, you know, the irony here is that Jimmy Carter might have been the most intelligent president of the 20th century. His successor, Ronald Reagan, was once described as an amiable dunce, unfairly. But Carter thought he was so smart that he could run the White House by himself. He didn't empower a chief of staff until 2.5 years in. I think the example of Haldeman and Watergate was chastened him. He didn't want that. It was a real problem. I mean, Reagan intuited something that Carter never understood, which is that an outsider president needs a consummate insider to get things done. And Reagan had Jim Baker, who became the gold standard for the White House chief.
When you look back at all the chiefs of staff, especially the ones that you talk to, who's the strongest that sticks out?
You know, I think almost all the White House chiefs, Democrat and Republican, would have James A. Baker III on their at the top of their list. I would say that Leon Panetta might be a close second. Bill Clinton, a year and a half into his administration, was really dead in the water. You know, he was consumed by Travelgate and Whitewater and various small scandals. He couldn't get any traction, and he brought Leon Panetta in to take over as White House chief. Panetta, with help from Erskine Bowles, his deputy, really organized that White House and turned it around. I think Clinton might have been a one-term president if not for Leon Panetta.
Is Rahm Emanuel the only elected official, or did the others go on to other careers in politics?
You know, he's one of the few. Rahm's one of certainly the only one I can think of off the top of my head that went on to elected office.
How taxing is this job? Because you look at the entire list that you have. I mean, Panetta lasted 3 years, but it seems like these guys only last a year and a half, maybe 2 years at the most. Some guys just won.
That's how unbelievably grueling the job is. The average tenure is a little less than 2 years. Andy Card set the record with, almost, you know, four. I think it was 4 years and 3 months. It's unbelievably grueling. Dick Cheney attributes his first heart attack to the stresses of the job. Bill Daley came down with shingles a couple of months after leaving. By the way, I'll be in your town at the Union League Club on Wednesday with Bill Daley and Sam Skinner for an event.
Reince Priebus, is he strong enough to be chief of staff, and how long do you think he'll last?
You know, this White House is the most dysfunctional in modern history. You know, the ineptitude is just off the charts here, and some of that is on Priebus. I mean, there have been rookie mistakes galore. Having an executive order go out, essentially written on the back of an envelope without vetting it.
But if I knew that, shouldn't the White House chief of staff know that?
Yeah, right.
They rush everything. Think it through. Take a beat.
But the larger problem in this White House may well be that the president of the United States doesn't understand. He hasn't learned the lesson that every other modern president has, which is that you have to empower a White House chief of staff as first among equals to execute your agenda and to listen to what you don't want to hear. And there's no indication that Trump wants to do that.
Learn from other people's mistakes. I mean, people need to live by that. The Gatekeepers will be in town Wednesday. Chris Whipple. Chris, thanks for joining us, man. 720 WGN, Pete McMurray in for Steve Cochran. We have a thank you. Sandberg Boyle.
We do. You know, it's the Chicago Artisan Chocolate Show, April 22nd and 23rd. And so they are at the Bailey Auditorium this week in the West Loop. You can go to chocolateevents.net to purchase tickets. And, you know, 2 weeks ago, they dropped off some Terry's Toffee for us. And
wait a second. We don't have any today.
All you guys were gone. So
yeah, what's
I got
this for us stuff.
So on Friday, they dropped off some Tate Wick treats.
Oh, ooh. I wonder who took it home.
So there were some dessert bars here, but you guys are already gone. So
come on. I stay later than most of you.
I was late here on Friday. Mm.
Yeah. I may not have looked very hard for you guys, but I enjoyed a pina colada bar, a turtle bar, a chocolate cherry bar. So
do you eat a lot of chocolate? Are you a chocoholic?
I'm a dessert person. She's I'm an eater in general, yeah. But I am a dessert. I'm a dessert.
Don't you hate when
cheesecake.
Skinny people say they're eaters?
I know, right?
Ice cream.
I'm an eater. I only weigh 90
pie.
Pounds.
I love pie.
No one makes pie anymore. I love it.
Yeah.
This is
I
really
love Starburst. I mean, I'm equal opportunity.
This is a really cool event, too.
Yeah. So anyway, I think we're going to give away some tickets, Pete.
Yes.
Yes. 312-981-7200.
You have the full thing to read.
Caller 9, where is the full thing? Is it right here?
Yeah, read it. It's the Chicago Artisan Chocolate
Show. Oh, and by the way, what did you see what else they have this year?
Uh-uh.
A charity wine tasting.
Oh, that's wine and chocolate?
Yeah.
Ooh, ooh. Am
two
I missing
favorite
it?
Things.
I put it in your rundown thing.
Okay, hold on a second. All right.
Got it?
The seventh caller. I do know that. It's going to be a seventh caller.
Oh, here it is. Four tickets to the Chicago Artisan Chocolate Show on April 22nd and 23rd at Plumbers Hall in the West Loop. You can learn more about this semi-sweet world and meet with over 50 artisans. Get tickets and delicious details at chicagoevents.net.
Yeah, also at fineartisanevents.com. As well.
There's some pictures. No one here got chocolate.
I didn't get chocolate.
Nope.
Mary?
Nope.
I love me some chocolate.
Nothing. Okay.
She took the chocolate covered cherry things too.
Sherry's berries?
Yeah.
She's a chocoholic, though.
Yes,
you know what,
is.
Though? You have to say, if anybody's going to really appreciate it, it'll be Mary Sandberg Boyle, Comcast Sportsnet.
Okay.
But even if we get a close second.
If we get beef sandwiches,
exactly.
We split
right?
The beef sandwiches.
Oh, yeah.
That's how it works.
You can have those.
Okay.
I'll going on that with you.
The Steve Cochran Show.
The golfing hero of Spain on this special date. And after so many years, once and for all for Sergio.
Justin wasn't making it easy. He was playing extremely well.
Sergio is obviously the best player not to have won a major no longer. Anytime one of those types of players, there's a handful of them, and anytime one of those guys gets that huge monkey off their back, I think it makes it a poignant major championship.
But I knew what I was capable of doing, and I believed that I could do it.
720 WGN 810, Sergio Garcia won the Masters yesterday. Sudden death. Our next guest in studio, you can see him on the Golf Channel and NBC Sports. Sports fresh from the Masters yesterday, where he was on TV yesterday, flew back to Chicago. It is Mark Rolfing. Thanks for coming in.
Well, good morning. Chicago's the only place I would have left Augusta for, I can tell you that.
Tell me about the experience, first of all. We'll talk about Sergio in a second, but just tell me about the experience, because as a horrible golfer, I've always wanted to play, Augusta. Of course, I'd lose 70, 80 balls. But tell me about the experience when you're there at the Masters. I know you've done it, but is it special every single time?
There's nothing like it. The thing that would surprise you the most and does surprise people on their first visit is the elevation, just how severe the slopes are and how many up and downs there are. The only flat lie is on the driving range before they go tee off. It just has a sense of history everywhere you walk. And I think one of the reasons why it has it is the players so embrace the Masters. If you asked 100 of the top players in the world if they could only win one more tournament in their career, which one would it be? 95 of them would tell you the Masters.
And Andrea, you've been there.
I've been. It's magnificent. It's majestic. We went to, if you ever go, I would encourage going to a playoff, the preview rounds before they actually start the tournament play, because that's half the fun. And the par three as well. It's just so pristine. It's so beautiful.
It's amazing to me how the Masters has grown its business so dramatically over the last couple decades. But they really haven't compromised the core of what they are. Billy Payne, the chairman, on Wednesday was asked if they were going to ever change the cell phone policy of no cell phones out there. And his answer was, you can ask the next chairman that question.
Right?
No
Why would kidding. They ever do that? Why would they change anything?
I don't know. They're building things. I can tell you that the press building that came up somehow miraculously from last year is about the size of Columbus Square. It's just gigantic. It's just a wonderful, wonderful experience beginning to end, whether it's practice rounds or being there on Sunday afternoon.
Dustin Johnson slipped on the stairs wearing socks. Is that true?
Yes, that's true. Yeah, there was a lot of speculation about what might have happened, but I was able to see evidence, and it was not on his back. It was on his elbow. So he had a major bruise and swelling on his elbow. So, yes, that's what happened. And I can tell you, knowing Johnson the way I do, he so wanted to play in the Masters. And I think had it been a warmer morning that morning, I think he might have tried it, but he just felt at the end there was no way.
We talked so much about Sergio before this tournament. Ironically, did you ever think you would see him win a tournament, let alone the Masters?
I did. His fiance was a reporter for the Golf Channel a year ago, so I was pretty close to that whole relationship developing. And I will tell you, this is a new and improved Sergio Garcia. 4 or 5 years ago, he was saying, I'll never win a major. I'm not good enough. I've had my chances. Oh, woe is me. Every bounce was a bad bounce. He has a completely different attitude on life now. He's going to get married in July, and I didn't know whether that would translate into a major championship or not, but I know that he did have a totally new attitude from about a year ago.
0-for-73 in majors, and he nails it yesterday on the playoff hole.
So much of that is attitude, Pete, I think. It was interesting. Ernie Els may have played his last round in the Masters yesterday. He's played in 23. And he was asked afterwards, you know, do you feel badly? You know, what do you think? And he said, you know what? I had 23 chances. If you can't get it done in 23, maybe it's just not meant to be. So I think so much is the way you look at it.
Is there any reason, Mark, to think that Sergio is still young, I mean, that he won't, and obviously it's never promised, but that he won't win some more majors?
I think he can. These athletes are much better conditioned now at the age of 37. You look at Sergio, he's practically chiseled. Yes, and I got to tell you, this is exactly what golf needed. One of the issues with golf is it doesn't have a real rooting base. Who's going to root against Justin Rose? Nobody. But who's going to root for Justin Rose? Not very many people, unfortunately. The Ryder Cup has become so successful because there's a tremendous rooting interest, and that's what Garcia brings. That majority of that crowd out there yesterday was rooting for Garcia.
Tell me about that tribute to Arnold Palmer when they were teeing off. Jack Nicklaus was crying. I mean, that was really a moment.
Really was. There was a big void. Arnold Palmer was so much part of the Masters, and he was so much really part of my life and my career. I wouldn't be sitting here today if it weren't for Arnold Palmer. He's the one who changed the game. Was he the greatest player that ever lived? No. Was he the most popular? I would say yes. And has anybody had more of an impact on the game of golf over the years than Arnold Palmer? I don't think so.
Yeah, I thought one of the cool moments was, I think it was Saturday with Jordan Spieth off the pine straw. When he asked his caddy, he said, what would Arnie do?
Yeah, I mean, that was a silly shot, I thought. I mean, it was only Saturday. Had it been Sunday, maybe you try that shot to try to pull it off. But to me, the safest play would have been a layup. But it's just amazing to me that Spieth was thinking about Arnold Palmer right at that moment. Right. It just shows you.
His impact, you're right. Mark Rolfing in studio with us. We're going to come back. Excuse me. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about Jackson Park in a second. Thank you for joining us. Let's take a look at traffic, Mayor. WGN 821 in studio with us from the Golf Channel, NBC Sports. Fresh from the Masters, it's Mark Rolfing. Thank you again for coming in. When did you fly in from the Masters?
I left Augusta at 12:30, and I was at Midway by 2 o'clock.
Okay, so you saw everything.
I saw everything from pretty much the 8th green on.
Okay. First of all, tell me about the Chicago Parks Golf Alliance. What is it?
Well, Chicago Golf needed a hub to sort of take a look at the various initiatives that might be possible to rejuvenate the golf brand in Chicago. So we formed this 501c3 Chicago Parks Golf Alliance, a little bit like what was done out in San Francisco a few years ago. But really, that is the hub organization, a charitable organization that then deals with the city, with the park district, with the Western Golf Association, with all the various entities. So it's really the hub of this initiative.
So you're trying to make golf affordable for all people?
Well, if not free for kids, the answer is yes. I mean, the three problems really that golf is faced with in today's world is the game's too difficult, it takes too long, and it costs too much. And really everything we're trying to do here revolves around how do we help work towards solving those three issues for the game.
If you want to play golf in the city, I mean, there are the Park District courses, but normally a lot of people go out to the suburbs to play the big country clubs.
Right.
Or yeah. I'll play South Shore, Merrivitz, Black, Robert Black up on the north side. But this is going to be, I think, this is going to combine Jackson Park and South Shore, right? It's going to make two big courses right in that area.
It is. We are not going to go, in terms of the restoration, outside the envelope of what is already there when it comes to golf. There's 27 holes. We're going to end up with 18 championship holes that are still at the same time playable for the community guys that play down there and ladies. But also we're going to develop a short course because we really feel like this is a project that can change the game and change the culture of the community down there when it views golf.
Yeah.
How's it being received, Mark, so far?
The reception has been just phenomenal. I wouldn't have gone along as far as I did if there had been significant opposition. It's interesting. Those two courses, Jackson Park and South Shore, been there for over 100 years, and they really haven't been fixed up since. Right. So irrespective of whether or not the BMW Championship ends up there, I believe the community needs to have those two courses fixed up. The drainage is terrible. It needs a new irrigation system. A lot needs to be done. The other thing is there hasn't been great access for the community over to the lakefront. And part of what we're going to do when we combine the two courses is create more access back and forth to the lake for the community that really has nothing to do with golf.
That's going to be great.
That's another thing. It's easy because of the trains. You can get there for kids and youth and whatever. Not all the courses. If you're going to go play out in Glencoe, they're going to take a train and then a cab. You know, it's
right.
So it's
right.
Actually a commuter-friendly area. For
why did this take so long? It seems like a no-brainer.
I don't know. There isn't really a core golf organization in this town. And I remember first talking with the mayor when we were really, you know, cranking up the thought of studying the feasibility of this. And he looked at me and said, you know, I think you're my golf guy. Go figure it out. And I sat there and
I
thought,
what are you going to say?
Well, yeah, what are you going to say? But also I thought, well, how come there isn't another golf guy? Where is the other golf guy? So it just needed a cheerleader. It needed a little bit of glue. And really, that's the role that I've played here.
I mean, you've seen a lot of golf in your lifetime. Who has the most natural swing? And you look at somebody and say, God, I wish I had that.
I thought you did. That's what I heard.
I need so much help with my game.
I don't know. Adam Scott, I would say, probably has the prettiest swing in the game. It really is a remarkable swing. But you're not going to see those beautiful natural swings as much anymore because it's turned into a power game at the highest level. And it's all about distance and overpowering golf courses now. That's why you're seeing more athletes like Dustin Johnson that are playing golf that would have turned to basketball or some other sport, let's say, a couple of decades ago, even.
He really wants to say Angel Cabrera has the most beautiful swing.
That's Mary's
favorite.
That's her favorite. Yeah.
The problems you mentioned that are facing golf, including the time it takes to play and the difficulty of the game, what are we doing to make it an easier game? Is it technology? Is it more instruction, more available instruction, and also to speed it up?
Yes, 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 and yes. The first thing is we have to change the rules. The rules are way too complicated, and particularly for beginning golfers that don't understand the rules, that's an impediment to them having enjoyment in playing the game. The second is we have to embark in an educational initiative to inform people that a golf course does not have to be green and lush and perfectly manicured like Augusta National. That's a once-a-year phenomena down there. And brown golf courses, where you don't put as much water on them, actually play easier for beginning golfers because you can bounce the ball, you can roll it onto the greens, but they don't have that in their mind yet. And so I think a lot of this is education. We have to spend less money maintaining our courses, and that then would translate into lower costs.
And I think because I'm involved in the first tee, and the something that we talk about there is the shorter courses, making the smaller courses for youth, the larger ones are unplayable, and it makes it unappealing because even if you play with kids and they tee off from the 100 or 150, there's a lot of sitting around for them that they're not interested in doing. So if you're going to get them out and excited, it has to be like a playable course.
Sure.
Also, that's why these public courses are really important, because most of the people playing golf didn't go to the country club with their parents, you know, and play during that.
They grew up on public courses.
Right. And so with the lack of those, there's a lack of kids playing. So that's another component of the Jackson Park thing, is there's going to be a facility for the first tee. So that's like a safe haven. There's a dire need for places to go for kids in that area. And this would be a place with adults that care about them, that are interested in teaching them core values that aren't even just about golf, more just about, you know, how to be a great person and respect each other.
That South Shore's always been a hidden gem too, though. It's right along the lakefront. It's quick. It's playable.
You're right.
I mean, so that's a perfect foundation for which to build this and build this new course.
You know, when Tiger Woods first looked at the property, which was August 11th of last year, we spent the entire day down there. And sure, he just could not believe. He was astonished by what he saw at South Shore. And he was astonished with the potential for lakefront holes. And saw this par three right on the lake, and saw a way to take the hole that goes right along Lakeshore now, where people are pinging cars all the time with balls and bend it inward.
Lost a few balls there myself, by the way.
Yeah, so he saw all that, but I will tell you, that was not what really convinced him that this is something worth doing. He must have asked me 10 times that day, where are all the kids?
Right.
It was a beautiful Thursday afternoon.
God, you're right.
Summer in Chicago, and he just kept saying, Mark, where are all the kids?
Yeah.
And that's what really hooked Tiger on this thing.
That's awesome.
And that's what's important. We have got a lack of that anywhere. Kids only do things in organized activities now. They don't just go out and play. They don't just go to the basketball courts. They don't just go, you know, to anything until it's organized. That's why if there was organized system there, like the first tee, kids would have things that they were enrolled in, and they'd be out there playing. And then once you learn how to play, you'll want to play all the other
first
time that's
such
available.
A great organization. I'm glad you brought that up too. It's a great organization. It gets kids involved, especially in caddying too.
We're going to have a caddy program, if you can believe this. Yeah. The golf course is obviously not going to be done this summer because we really haven't begun the construction work yet, but we are going to start instituting programs down there. And the Western Golf Association is going to be sort of the guiding light of a caddy program that's going to start at Jackson Park this summer, where kids can get jobs and learn how to caddy. And you're going to be able to go down there and play Jackson Park and take a caddy. And it's going to be subsidized and paid for by the Western Golf Association.
That's fantastic.
Great. What is the website? People can get more information.
ChicagoParksGolfAlliance.com.
Mark Rolfing.
.org.
Thank you for coming in. Fresh off the Masters, Mark Rolfing. Good to see you.
All right, thanks, guys.
It's 720 WGN.
The Steve Cochran Show.
Hey, hey, hey! Baseball season's underway. Well, you better get
8:42, Pete McMurray in for Steve Cochran, the home opener on the north side. Joining us, the former pitcher for the Chicago Cubs, our good buddy, it's Kerry Wood, number 34. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
We are excited for today. We're all going to Bernie's. We'll see you there around 2 o'clock. You're buying the first round.
2 o'clock? You know it's going to be raining, right? You got to pace yourself.
Right, of course.
Might have a late start tonight.
All right, can we talk about Game 7 for a second? I love bringing this up because you look like a little kid on television. Cleveland, Game 7, the final out. The camera cuts to the VIP area. There's Kerry Wood and John Cusack holding their phones, recording. You're taking video of this moment. I mean, I loved it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was actually Game 1 with me and Cusack in there. I can't my wife wouldn't let me live it down if I said I was at Game 7 with Cusack and not her. But, yeah, it was, and I got blown up all over social media for holding my phone the wrong way when I was apparently videoing or taking a picture or whatever it was I was doing. I just wanted to capture the first World Series in our lifetime, the World Series win in our lifetime. So I just wanted to get that final out.
I mean, I can't imagine what it was like for the players. As a fan, it was off the charts crazy. But as a former player, what was it like for you?
I mean, a huge range of emotions. Obviously, you've been out there and you've been on the teams that have tried to fight for that same thing and didn't get it done. And You know what those guys are going through. You know what they've had to go through the entire season, and aches and pains and all the adversity that comes at a team throughout the course of a long season. And you know what their families have been through to get to this point. And then as an ex-player, you start thinking of all the times, all the opportunities you had, and then all the players before you, the Santos, the Billy Williams, the Fergie Jenkins, and you just think about those guys and happy for them and their families, because their families have gone through the same thing that we all have. So just a lot of emotions from an ex-player and from someone that had a chance to go out there and try to get it done. But to sit there and watch these guys and this group of young kids go out there and do it the way they did it and the fashion they did it and the fun they had throughout the summer, and I mean, just the way Game 7 went, you know, played out was just unreal.
Did you get choked up? Did you cry? Because I fully admitted I cried when they won it.
You know, I did not when it happened. I was excited, and then as I started doing a couple interviews in the clubhouse afterwards, and I found myself getting a little choked up. Just like I said, talking about
everybody else
and Ernie's and guys that, you know, that's what got me choked up, talking about the guys that are no longer with us that didn't get a chance to see it.
Kerry, what's the thing you're most looking forward to tonight?
Just getting underway, right? I mean, I think it's just that the city has a buzz when baseball's in town, so especially when the Cubbies open it up. So obviously the weather could be a little bit better today. I hope we get it in. I think we're going to, but it's just a lot of excitement. I mean, it's these guys all came from Arizona still, and they probably sent their stuff ahead of time, but they probably didn't get in until last night. So you know, it's exciting for them. They're getting their houses together. They're getting their lockers together. They get to the clubhouse and get all their stuff and try to get ready for opening day. But there's a lot of hoopla around opening day. It's exciting, especially in the north side after winning the World Series. It's going to be electric, I'm sure, and probably is already starting to fill up down there in Wrigleyville. So it's going to be a great day, and obviously the players love opening day and love the excitement that comes along with it.
Have you guys, by the way, seen the jerseys that the Cubs will wear tonight?
I haven't seen them. I've heard about them. I can't wait to see them.
Yeah, they look really cool. Have you seen them, Kerry?
I haven't seen them, no. I have not.
They have the gold on there, right? On the lettering.
Gold lettering, gold numerals.
Okay.
Is that just an opening day jersey?
It's for the opener.
Are they going to wear it Wednesday too when they get their rings, possibly? Or is it just tonight?
They're going to wear them Wednesday also.
Okay. Yeah. Kerry, nice. John Lester, after the banner goes up tonight, you know, World Series champions, the first time in forever. I mean, is Lester nervous or just excited? Do you think he'll be a little nervous tonight?
No, I don't think that guy gets nervous. No, I don't think that's part of his makeup. I don't think that's in him. No, I think he's ready to take the ball, ready to go, and I think he's disappointed with the outcome of his first game in St. Louis, even though he threw the ball really well. I think he is all business today, and for him, this is another day. For him, today is probably not as exciting with all the hoopla for the starting pitcher on opening day at home. There's a lot of delays, a lot of extra, all the announcements, so your routine kind of gets changed up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So he's probably itching to get going and could do without all the opening day hoopla, but he's probably the starting two pitchers are probably the only two guys that don't care for that opening day hoopla, because they're trying to get their timing down to time it to get their warm-ups all set up. So, but this guy does not get nervous. He's been in too many Game 7s. He's been in the World Series. He's obviously, we saw what he did in Game 7,
yes,
so a home opener doesn't even raise his pulse.
Kerry, I think the natural excitement has everybody saying, let's do it again, let's do it again. I mean, that's just the natural course of it. But do you think we can do it again? And what do we have to do to do it besides stay healthy and keep our guys?
Well, I mean, honestly, I mean, I think the teams that think they have a shot, that's the main goal, is to stay healthy. We got off to a rough start last year losing Schwarber early. And, you know, we get a whole season with this guy in our lineup now. And I tell you what, I haven't seen a whole lot of all the games yet, but I know that – and starting as an opposing pitcher, if I had to start the game facing Schwarber, Bryant, and Rizzo, and those and that threesome in a row,
jeez,
that's
man,
that's a tough first inning to start a game. You don't get to get your feet wet. You got to jump right into that. So, could be a fun year.
Yeah, how would you like to be the Dodgers tonight? Because you're the team that lost to the Cubs in the NLCS. Now you got to come in here and watch them raise the banner, and then two nights from now, watch them get their rings. That can't be fun for the visiting team.
No, it's not going to be, and it's going to be electric, and they're going to come out hot, and it's going to be loud, and I expect big things tonight. But this team is built to last, and it's built to be here for a while, and You know, we've got a huge, great core that's young and is going to be with us for a long time. And again, I know it sounds simple to say, but if we stay healthy, there shouldn't be. We're about the only thing that's going to get in our way.
Right. And a big thank you to your wife, Sarah, for stepping aside tonight so I can sit with you at the game for the home opener. I tell her I love her for that.
I mean, yeah, I will. I'll let her know.
Yeah, that's really, really great. Kerr, great to talk to you, man. Hopefully I'll see you later today.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, man.
Talk to you guys.
Kerry Wood,
thanks.
The best. The best.
Thank
you. Yep. So are you really sitting with Kerry tonight?
No.
He didn't sound like he was aware of that.
Sound a little surprised.
No. I just like, what? I'm not telling my wife. Could you imagine?
I got Cusack. I got my wife. I don't have McMurray under here.
Let's see. Cusack, Chelios, Kerry, and Sarah.
I don't see a fifth ticket for
no,
you.
No, that is not happening. 854-720 WGN. Pete McMurray in for Steve Cochran. Cubs home opener today. We have a Cubs book to give away right now to caller number 7 at 312-981-7200. The Cubs Way, the Zen of Building the Best Team in Baseball and Breaking the Curse by New York Times bestseller Tom Verducci. Available everywhere that books are sold. So caller number 7 will set you up with the book, The Cubs Way. Okay. What else do we have?
We have the Masters results from our show picks.
Who took Dustin Johnson, by the way?
Well, anybody? A bunch of people, but Steve allowed people to repick if they wanted.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I didn't agree
After
with,
he fell but... down the stairs because of his socks?
Yes.
I still don't believe
well,
that.
Well, he still went out there to tee off on Thursday.
I know.
He was kicking a few
back. If you picked him, you should have been stuck with him, but that's...
I mean, he's got this house. He's got his buddies there.
I do agree.
Having some drinks.
Because I was in a different pool for Pride, of course. And what? We weren't allowed to repick. If you picked him, you picked him.
Yeah, I mean, that's
okay. Well, I would have been fine with that. But since the rule was we could switch,
right.
I switched.
Yes,
I did too.
I think we all did.
No, I don't think
actually,
we all did.
Actually, Spike kept Dustin. Spike Odell, he picked.
Spike.
And what? Spike finished in ninth place because he kept Dustin Johnson.
No.
That's what happened.
He was our celebrity picker.
Oh, I know. I heard it.
I was in eighth place. But there was a time, Matthew Fitzpatrick, who played for Northwestern, Go Cats.
Okay.
There was a time on
Go
Thursday
Cats.
Where he was leading.
He was.
Oh,
yeah. He was.
So if you recall, guys, I took a photo and sent it all to you. So.
That's what
we thought.
Mm-hmm. a lot of golf left.
Yeah. Seventh place, Mary Vandeveld.
Yes. I made progress. Nobody got cut. No, none of the four
That's
people
good.
I picked got cut.
All right, not bad, Mary.
Oh, how did
Thank
you say?
You.
Got the boot.
The boot.
Mike Jacobson finished in sixth place.
Oh,
wow.
Bennett Mikey. Finished in fifth place.
Dave Bennett.
I had
Bennett.
Both.
WGN.
I had both Spieth and Fowler, and they both let me down yesterday.
Go catch.
I was feeling good Saturday
it's
night.
Tough.
I had them too.
Mike Jacobson's girlfriend Audrey Wayne finished in fourth place.
See, I don't agree with this. Why is Audrey in this?
Because she knows golf.
She is
know.
A good golfer, yeah.
Not part of the show,
well,
though.
Spike knows
She
golf,
and I are in a little bit of a disagreement right now because she thinks that Sergio's fiance's skirt was too short, and I think it was super cute. So, but I'm still giving her fourth place win.
It was funny to watch Sergio's wife and Justin Rose's wife. How about that?
They when they were hugged. I know.
Yeah,
that was a meme, like,
right.
instantly.
Those two are hot.
That's his fiance.
That's not what
fiance, yes.
Sorry.
Not married yet.
This summer.
Yes,
they're
hot.
They were both besties on that 18th hole.
Steve Cochran finished third.
Ooh.
Oh, way to go.
All right.
Steve's not here. All right. Okay. Good job,
so
Steve.
So the last two people we have are Steve's mom and Andrea.
Woo. It was just because I picked Justin Rose, wasn't it?
I will tell you who finished in first place is Miss Andrea Darlis.
Really? Oh. it was just because I got to repick, but... I always will pick Justin Rose.
Her lineup, Jordan Spieth, Rory McIlroy, Ricky Fowler, and Justin Rose. Yeah. So pretty darn good.
Ooh, nice job.
Good right. job, Andrea.
Good job.
So it's a combination of all four? Because you guys do these pools. I don't understand. And I'm participating.
Neither
I still
do
don't
I,
get
Pia.
It.
There,
okay.
I try to fight it every time.
We
I
take
don't understand
normal
it.
Picking and then jack it up to a level that makes
that
sense.
That no one understands.
I want to commend the judge because it's a very hard task for her to come up with the score, and she's got to keep all our picks in line. So huge props to Mary Sandberg Boyle, Comcast Sportsnet, for keeping score.
Well, you're saying that now because you won. If you were in third place, you wouldn't agree with it. it.
I mean, technically, I never did the NCAA results because I lost everyone's picks. So I lost that paper.
What do you mean,
yeah,
lost them?
And I did really good in that.
You can't lose them.
I lost the piece of paper. I don't know what happened to it. So.
And you should have heard what Andrew was saying about Mary during the
football.
Oh, yes. I won this
game. She likes me now.
Wait a second.
No, I did not say that. But at least I beat Dave Bennett.
So what does Andrea get for winning?
Nothing.
Okay.
Pride.
Pat on the back.
Little pat on the back.
Bring it over. Oh, nice job.
Big hug.
All right.
That
That's it. Good job. Okay. 2 minutes before 9 o'clock, we'll be joined by CLTV in just a second. It's 720 WGN.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
She was the fairy tale princess and perhaps the most beloved woman, not only in England, but in the world. Princess Diana was the people's princess, and the world was her stage.
Diana could be very charming, very personable. She was very natural. She had the ability to generate and create affection for herself. It's a rare gift, but she certainly had it in spades.
WGN, Pete McMurray in for Steve Cochran. You can see our next guest weeknights at 6:30 on CBS2 as the host of Entertainment Tonight. That was from her new show on the Reels Network called Nancy O'Dell Remembers. It is Nancy O'Dell. Nancy, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. You know, one of the things that I usually get in radio, the first question out of people's mouths when they find out that I do a radio show is, what's the best interview you've done and what's the worst interview you've done? Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard that. And now that you have this show, you got to answer that question.
Well, I've been doing it for so long. It'd be hard to remember everything, but that's what I'm doing with the show, is Nancy O'Dell Remembers. It's, you know, it's going to be on the Reels channel at 9 p.m. every Monday. So tonight it's at 9 p.m. And it's talking about those stories that, you know, were so shocking that you remember where you were and what you were doing when you heard them. And so one of my most memorable ones that I talk about, the story that I covered, aired last week, it was Princess Diana, because I'd started out in entertainment news as the host of Access Hollywood back in 1996. And shortly after that, I was being sent on a plane to London to cover, you know, the horrible tragedy, the tragic accident of Princess Diana. And some of the others that have certainly been my most memorable stories that I've covered have been like the death of Robin Williams, Michael Jackson, Joan Rivers. Tonight's episode talks about Joan Rivers, and you're going to learn new information. I think that you're probably going to be like, I didn't know that. And I also talk about what it's like to cover it behind the scenes, because it's like I sit down to do an interview with Melissa Rivers, and having gone into that interview, having lost my mom, and, you know, on Entertainment Tonight when you see it, you see me doing the interview, and I got to be strong and not break down and cry, and because I got to be a journalist. And what, you know, was really going on behind the scenes is that, you know, it was hard to get through that interview because I had lost my mom, and I so understood what Melissa was going through, and she had become somebody who was a friend because I knew her on the red carpet. And so to hear her talk about crawling in the bed next to Joan and what it was like knowing that her mom was going to pass away and being there for her. So it's just a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff, how things come in, you know, how we discern between what's fact and fiction, but then also just recounting the story itself.
Right.
We all relate to, because so many people, these entertainers are such a big part of our lives. You know, you can probably remember where you were when Thriller came out.
Well, you brought up Princess Diana. It took me back to Tom's Tap in Rockford. I remember when they made that announcement. But, you know, everybody remembers moments like that in their life. But how do you handle it as a journalist? Okay, Princess Di passes away. Now you have to go there and you have to talk to her family and get as much information as you can and put it on TV. That's rough.
Yeah, and that's what this will show you, is a lot of how we gather that information and how I covered it. I documented everything that, you know, when I would go cover these things. I'm a huge, huge, you know, diary keeper and would take a lot of photos. And so you're going to see some of my own personal photos and what it was like to go cover some of these stories. You're going to hear a lot of that. But like I said, reliving the story in itself, too, which I know because I did the voiceovers for the show. I know what the show entails, and watching it was still so fascinating because, you know, these people were such a big part of our lives. You know, I said to me, I felt so sad after Robin Williams passed away, and I think it was because I watched Mork and Mindy growing up. So it was like, it felt like I was mourning a piece of my childhood, you know?
Nancy, I just want to tell you, you're such a great interviewer. I mean, you ask such poignant questions with getting to the heart of the emotion without being offensive. I mean, you're just a wonderful interviewer. I
appreciate that.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed hearing your best and worst interview too. But it is hard, I'm sure, as you mentioned, you were talking about your mom, to walk that fine line between wanting to break down when you're interviewing someone that has a subject so close to your heart.
Yeah, it's very tough, and feeling like you can't, because you got to be the journalist and ask the questions. And, you know, fortunately, I knew Melissa, so she did feel like a friend. But you'll see how tough, you know, that is tonight on Reels when you see the Nancy O'Dell Remembers the series. It's tough to get through some of those stories. But they're just these moments in all of our lives that are just such big moments. And, you know, and I say the reason it is because they were such a big part of our childhood. You know, it's like, you probably remember, you know, when you heard the Michael Jackson news, again, where you were and what you were doing.
Right.
And it's just because they entertained us for so long in our lives. And there's this feeling, you know, I talk about this too, is there's this feeling that nothing can happen to them. We all knew that Michael Jackson was having troubles, but you still feel like they're larger than life and nothing can happen to them. And you realize that, okay, well, they are human and things do happen, and it's just so shocking.
Well, you bring up Michael Jackson. I think everybody was shocked with that one. But, you know, he had that personal side that you never really heard about. But Robin Williams affected me, and I think it affected a lot of people. Yeah. When he passed away, it's like, oh, my God.
It was crazy.
I can't believe it.
You had no idea.
Yeah.
And the things that you learn, too. You know,
the depression.
Said to somebody, I thought he was like one of the, I thought he was one of the happiest people on earth.
Right.
You know, and when you put this all together in one show, you realize, too, I said that, you know, I had covered his passing, and he was one of my favorite people to interview, because you would ask one question, and he would just keep on going and going and going. It was funny. And then the more that you would laugh, the more he would get funny. You know, he'll get funnier. And it was almost like you would leave the interview almost like on a high, you know, and it's one, you know, when you go back, you compile all these things together. So then you talk about having done all these interviews and what it was like to talk to him and how he acted and, you know, how he would become more and more excited as you would do the interview because he wanted to entertain so much. You realize now, knowing a lot of his history and recounting everything that, you know, there was, you know, the depression and things like that that took place, and why these interviews would mean so much to him, because he actually felt happier if he was making people happier. So you realize that in a way, you know, he was dealing with that. But then also,
right,
we go back and we pull some footage. I said that, you know, one of the reasons it hurts so bad is because I used to love to watch Mork and Mindy. Well, I've had my daughter, who is 9, we have watched an episode. We've gotten through all seasons and stuff because I just loved it so much. Well, she fell in love with it too. And I didn't realize in one season of Mork and Mindy that he actually, and we show this on the program when we talk about remembering Robin Williams, that at one time Mork actually meets Robin Williams. So Robin Williams guest stars at Robin Williams on Mork and Mindy. So they show this interview, you know, via the magic of television,
right,
where, you know, Mork and Robin Williams are in the same room. And Robin Williams is talking about the fact of how tough it is to be a celebrity and how you feel like you have to perform all the time. And sometimes you feel like your life has been taken away because, you know, nobody treats you as real, and you feel like you have to say yes to everything. And you know, Mork, actually, at the end of the episode, when he's talking to Orson, and we show some of this in the scene, he's telling Orson that, you know, it's you know, sometimes they feel like they don't have their own lives, and that's why some of these tragedies happen. And he goes through a lot of the celebrities who have passed away, which is weird and ironic and bizarre, because then this is what happens to him, you know, in the end. And it's just a very poignant moment of remembering all that and kind of tying it all together.
Do you get emotional when you're looking back at these interviews? Because it sounds like it.
Yeah.
I do. Oh, I do, big time. I mean, you know, the Melissa Rivers interview was one of the toughest ones to get through, just because I had lost my mom as well. But I do, and going back and remembering them, and I wanted to honor them too. So it's recounting everything. I think you'll learn some information that you've never learned about their passing, and, you know, some of the things that happened and leading up to it.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're like, wow, I didn't know that. And again, you know, pulling it all together, it's when they happen, you're getting pieces and tidbits here and there. And this is kind of, you know, putting it all in one place.
You know, you brought up Robin Williams, how it was a double-edged sword for him, because he fed off the energy when he made people happy, but he always felt like, mm-hmm, he had to perform. But he was one of those guys that every time you saw him, he made you happy. Or if you saw him on TV, he made you laugh.
Always.
He did. Oh, my gosh. And, you know, I remember that in the episode, too. It was like I talk about the fact that the behind-the-scenes things that you wouldn't see. Like I take my dad to one of the interviews with Robin Williams. And Robin, in the middle of the interview, said something funny. And he was like, "Who's your daddy?" You know? And then he actually looks over at my dad. He's like, "Oh, well, your dad's right over there. There's your daddy." You know? And it was like, it's just like such a silly moment. But it's just, you know, the things you don't see that he actually is doing in real life and how he would affect the camera guy and, you know, the producer. And it was just, just some of those moments that remember and honor them, too.
Yeah, a few years ago, I had a night show here at WGN, and we had the opportunity, we had the honor of having Joan Rivers on, and she had such a good time the first time she came back. And I felt like doing an evening show after 7 o'clock, stars were more relaxed, they'd open up. Joan couldn't have been funnier. Every single appearance she came on this radio station, she was so good, and everything was off the cuff and very quick. Yeah.
I know, up and, you know, into here she is in her 80s, I say, at the height of her career. And tonight we remember Joan Rivers. But it's talking about how she broke all those ceilings for the women and you know, how the road was really tough for her being a female. But she was at the height of her career, and she was able to maintain being relevant all of these years, you know, that mm-hmm. she was here talking about the fashion of people that were a third of her age, you know, and she's the one critiquing them. And you know, one of the things that you learned tonight in the series, too, is that Melissa's saying that Joan had no idea. She just thought everybody hated her. She thought that nobody liked her at all.
Oh, my God.
And
I remember.
Little did.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Yeah. She was saying that how after her death, all these celebrities came up to her saying how much they admired her and how funny they were, just like what you said, and how funny they thought she was, and that it would have been such an honor for her to actually have known that while she was living, that people actually really did like her and appreciate her talent, and they considered it an honor to be critiqued by her.
I wrote Joan Rivers a letter when I was in high school, and you know, back in the day when you wrote letters, and I just told her I thought she was so funny and such a great role model for women. She wrote me back. I mean, maybe it was her assistant or whatnot, but and I still have it. It was a little hand typed letter on pink paper with a pink envelope, and it was, you know, it was just saying thank you for the letter, I appreciate it, you know, follow your dreams, good luck in life, Joan Rivers. It was just, I thought it was so cool that she or, even you know, she and her assistant took the time to do that. So she was great.
That is so cool. And so you remember. I mean, that's the thing that I was saying about this series that hits home so much. It's like you remember that it was a pink piece of paper and a pink envelope.
Right.
Because, you know, it affected your life so much. And, you know, I don't want to overstate it, but I say that these people who entertained us, you know, were such a big part of our memories and so much a part of our growing up because their work or their production, you know, meant it would reflect that period of time in your life. Like I said, I just would, you know, for me, it was like so crushing to cover the Robin Williams story. And I was actually on vacation. I talk about this in the series, is that I was on vacation and I was called back, and I considered it such an honor to be able to go back and relive his career, because having watched Mork and Mindy was just some of my, I don't know, it was just some of my best childhood memories. I just thought it was such a fun show. And I remember sitting, you know, that television and what it looked like, and my parents, you know, in the den, you know, in the room there, and sitting there and eating Cheetos as I would watch it. You know, it's just such a big part of our memories growing up.
Right. Nancy O'Dell remembers tonight on Reels, and of course, the host of Entertainment Tonight on CBS2. Nancy, great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, too. You guys have a great day.
All right. Talk soon.
Nancy.
It's 720 WGN. You know, I always say that I hate musicals, but I don't. Mary Poppins, I love. Sound of Music, I love. La La Land, not so much.
Chicago,
not so much.
Come
the Blues Brothers, yes. Love it.
You think that's a musical? Yeah, I guess it kind of is, yeah.
The Blues Brothers is a musical,
yeah,
right?
Kind of.
Mary Poppins?
Well, I wouldn't
musical?
I don't know if I'd put them on the same level, but
yeah,
It's a stretch, but maybe.
I was on my way to Vegas a week and a half ago, and they had La La Land. I'm like, this is great. I can have a drink, kick back, watch La La Land. I turned it off after 7 minutes.
Stop
it. It's like, please, Emma Stone. All of a sudden, they break in the song. I was bored.
La La Land was so good.
My husband fell asleep too, Pete.
Nick D. Remember we had Nick D on? I was filling in for Steve, and Nick D is like, Pete, this is different.
Yeah.
No, it
he
wasn't.
He said, if you're not inspired by that first scene, that
I wasn't. No, I
come
wasn't.
On.
I was inspired by my vodka soda on the way to Vegas. We have a pair of tickets to see the Tony Award-winning musical Disney's Mary Poppins, now playing through May 28th at the Mercury Theater in Chicago. You can bring the whole family, spend a jolly holiday with Mary Poppins and an irresistible cast of characters. For tickets at mercurytheater.com or call 773-325-1700. Let's do caller number 7 at 312-981-7200. And one more thing about Nancy O'Dell before we take a quick break and talk to John DeCoss and get the big story. You brought up the fact that you wrote Joan Rivers a letter when you were a kid.
I did.
Suddenly I had this flash when we went in the commercials. I wrote Christy McNichol a letter.
From a family?
Yes.
Remember?
No one remembers family.
Yeah, she... and you know what? I'll tell you her character name, too. It's how weird
Buddy.
I am. Buddy.
Buddy.
Yeah.
Hey, my buddy. Buddy. Yeah.
Is it where you get the buddy?
Buddy, no, but I asked her out and I never heard back. I'm like, hey.
then a few hours
what
later.
What are you doing next month?
Cook County Sheriff shows up at your door.
Right, yes.
TRO.
Yeah, that's not good. All right, the big story coming up next. A Cook County judge killed this morning. Andrea with details next on 720 WGN. Found a thank you for it. Nine 41, Pete McMurray in for Steve Cochran on 720 WGN and live on CLTV. We need to thank Manoli.
Yeah, we do. The hot dog king, America's dog. Manoli brought in some hot dogs for opening day. We have some bacon cheddar burgers as well, opening day special. Simply say, hey, it's opening day. You know what you can get, Pete? A $1 Chicago dog all day.
Really?
Limit 2 per person. Yep.
How good looking is Manoli? He's a good looking man.
Manoli, Greek. He's my man. Hey, it's opening day. Dollar hot dog. So thanks to Manoli and everybody at America's Dog.
I've known his brother George Apalapalap for many, many years. He's got Cappies over off Tui up there.
Probably a cousin of mine somehow down the road.
All the Greeks are related, like
related.
The Lebanese.
That's right.
Yes. On the phone with us, our old buddy, it's John DeCoss. John, this is great. Finally, we're on the show together.
I know. It took that. And I apologize to you. I'm a little under the weather. I had 7 hot dogs this morning. I wanted to be part of this show. And 7's too many.
Mm.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, it's a little bit too much. And how many times do I text you during the show saying, I need a theme song? I need a parody. You're making a parody for everybody. I need one.
You're going to get one. There's no question about it. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to it. It's going to happen. It's going to happen, Pete.
I like it.
He even said over the weekend it's going to debut, I thought you said, in like 2036?
2036. I will not be around.
Yeah, I'm going to be delayed a little bit. I'm going to Iceland about 3 o'clock.
All right.
Uh-huh. You two were together on Saturday night.
Yeah, we were.
Oh, were we together? Yes.
Told you not to bring
it
up.
Yeah, we did a show also.
Yeah, we did.
Oh. Tell me.
Yeah, we had a great time on Saturday at the Metropolis Theater. And
John, tell me about Andrea's material.
Yeah, please, John. No. Tell us about Andrea's material.
No,
we heard about it at 6 a.m. I'd like to hear about it again.
Her opening bit about Dave Bennett was she threw the mic down and walked off.
I did. It was a mic drop.
Can you give us one of those jokes, Andrea?
I just was saying, you know, it's okay. So we're in the showcase now, and aside from Mary, who's in a different room, Mary, who's on a different floor,
right?
It's hard being a woman just in a room full of guys. I mean, you're kind of looked at differently, you're judged differently.
Uh-huh.
How much makeup you wear?
Right.
You should wear high heels, a dress, a skirt. I said it drives Dave Bennett and I crazy.
It took me a second.
Wow.
But then I added the part about Dave being like a brother, father, great-grandfather figure to most of us.
Dave, why do you put up with that?
He rolls his eyes, John. He didn't quite have the same
reaction.
John,
you approved of that?
I did. Let me just clarify. I did not see the script prior to airing. Let's establish that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, actually, it was absolutely phenomenal because everybody pulled together at the Metropolis, obviously because Steve on Friday had to say, I can't do it. Yeah. And Joe Keefe, the director, and Holly Marshall. And then, of course, a big, big applause to Pat Tomasulo, who came in last second and pulled us through it. So it was great. It
killed
was absolutely great.
Pat Tomasulo and you, John. Oh, hilarious. Tomasulo just... John opened the set. Pat closed it out. It was just the perfect bookends.
Hey, guys. Ryan up in the newsroom, I watched it, too. It was fantastic. You guys all did great. I just want to tell you, you did fantastic. And Tomasulo, I was literally crying. It was so funny.
Yeah, he's great.
Pat's funny, man.
And Ryan has to say that because he got free tickets.
Yeah.
What? Wait a second.
Ryan and his beautiful wife came out to the show. Thanks, Ryan.
Well, thank you for the tickets. It was an awesome show. It was really, really great.
No, I'm so glad you could go, Ryan. I really am.
For free.
Awesome.
And it was funny because we were sold out. I think we lost about 70 people who specifically wanted to see Steve. And they weren't mad or anything like that.
No, they were actually holding protests out there.
Yeah.
There were protests.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I saw a few of them. They had pickets. Picketing. They all had beers in their hands.
That
was strange.
John, how... How would you rate Andre on a scale from 1 to 10? Is this your first time doing stand-up?
This is my third.
Oh, okay.
Very nervous. I mean, it's so... I commend you, John, and Pat, and Steve for doing it because, I mean, you're completely out of your element. We speak to, you know, millions of people on the radio, and we can get up and speak at events. That's not a problem. But to just completely try and make people laugh and speak off the cuff, it's...
And the
I commend
timing,
you guys, John.
The timing of a joke and
very
knowing when to pause... And waiting.
Yeah, but don't you think when you do it at the expense of others, it's not that hard?
It was funnier.
Oh, well, Dave, John, why don't you invite Dave out to do stand-up?
I did. Dave was busy. He had, was it a cotillion or something on Saturday? What did you have?
An auction.
An auction.
Mm-hmm. An auction. Seriously, you still do that? You still...
Sure,
well,
sure. Yeah, it's kind of like broadcasting.
Okay. Some people have to find brides, John.
I asked you about my sports memorabilia. You never even got back to me what it was worth. So, whatever. Okay. No, but I did ask Dave. I also asked Mary, and Jake was going to do it. Mary Sandberg also was going to do it. They all slowly backed out.
I had a baby shower.
Oh,
they were all
you
busy.
You left us up there?
I had a baby
shower.
Sandberg couldn't do it.
Oh. I was never going
Step
to do
kids.
It. I said no from the beginning.
Right.
He asked me. John, is that not how it? You asked me like 6 months ago, and I looked at the calendar. I said, kid weekend, not doing it.
Can't do it.
Did you say no as soon as he said, Mary, would you be available before the word came out?
No.
Thank you.
The week of my wedding, I approached him and I said, just so you know, I am not available for New Year's Eve. I hadn't even been asked to do anything yet, but I wanted him to know.
Yeah.
Well, when is the next show? Do you have anything planned?
We have a couple planned, but we don't have the dates set for those.
Okay.
But I will tell you this. Here's where... Andrea needs to be complimented because we do this all the time. This is Andrea's third time, and she just walks up there, and I'm telling you, and Ryan can attest to this, she is natural. She just goes through it. I can't believe she just runs up there. She did about, what'd you do, between 15 to 20 minutes, Andrea?
Yeah, I have to thank my mom, too, because she was a lot of my material. She wasn't in the audience.
She wasn't there.
Oh, good. I feel better now. It's not just me.
David, my mom.
You got some digs in on Springfield, too.
Oh, yeah. John, the Springfield jokes were great about Springfield being a lot like the Vatican. You know, Springfield.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
She just comes up. She just does these things. It's amazing. It's amazing. She was so good. We had Hannah Stanley on the show as well.
She was great.
Our good friend Tim Banker, who does the best Steve Bertrand other than Steve Bertrand. So we it was so much fun. The people were so good. And Pete, have you ever done stand-up?
I've never done stand-up.
Oh. Who's
ever.
Next?
When's the next show?
I was going to say.
I'm busy. I can't do any.
I'm pulling
a Sandberg.
I can't. I'm pulling a Sandberg.
I'm for Sandberg.
I'm with Pat Boyle that night. I'm looking at my calendar now.
I'm confused about one thing. How many Steve Bertrand impersonators are there?
Just the one.
Just one.
Right now?
And he nailed it.
Yeah, so Tim, he does the best.
They're at all the Target stores the third week of May. So there's I think there's 15 of them now.
Okay.
Awesome.
Okay, good.
John DeCoste. John, I love you, buddy.
Oh, thank you so much, guys.
Okay. Love you, John. You're the best. Thank you.
All right. Have a good trip.
See you, man.
Thanks, John.
John DeCoste, Saturday night.
Oh, he's awesome.
You killed it. I want to see, I want to see some footage. Is there any video?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
No. Are you sure?
No.
Boy, you answered too quickly.
No.
I mean, there's got to be video out there. I'm sure John has something.
It's erased.
Just sit here and she can rip me right in front of you. You don't need to watch
Dave,
a video.
You're just a small part. You're just a small part.
What are you saying about Dave?
Really?
I'll tell you. That'll be my next set. Right. That'll be the 10 o'clock hour.
We're live on CLTV and 720 WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Pete McMurray in for Steve Cochran. Bill and Wendy coming up right after 10 o'clock. We're still live on CLTV. This is how today is going to play out. We're going to see sun, we're going to see rain, and repeat. That's how it's going to be. Wind, sun, rain, repeat.
It's okay because many opening days, right, we've been snowed on at Wrigley. So this is okay. A little rain, a little sun, 60 degrees. It's okay.
I do not have a ticket yet, but I've been to every single opening day since 1994, the home opener, but I've missed 1 year, and it was 4 years ago when my wife planned spring break.
Ah.
We were in Scottsdale.
Do you stand on the corner and say, who's got one? Who's got one?
Yeah, you just ask around.
Okay.
Who's got one?
You know people.
Well, I mean, there's always tickets available. But don't go online. They're way too expensive.
Yeah.
$100 over face, $200 over face.
Right.
Crazy.
Just suck up to your friends who have season tickets.
Sweet Alley's spring treat box filled with sweet and savory baked goods. We have some to give away right now at 312-981-7200. Let's do caller number 7. Sweet Alley's certified gluten-free bakeries are located in Hinsdale and Glenview and are now taking orders for your Easter celebrations. Details at sweetalis.com. Okay? You got to think about Easter. It's coming up. It's Sunday.
Yeah, and I'm so bummed. We have usually the Greek Easter is a week after.
Yeah.
So we get everything half off. Not this year.
My great grandmother was Greek Orthodox. Mm-hmm. So one of my earliest childhood memories was we would do Easter Mass. Then a week later or 2 weeks later, we would do Greek Orthodox. And I remember going to church and it lasted forever.
I know. It goes on.
Forever.
And on.
And the singing.
I know.
What are you guys doing?
I realized on Palm Sunday yesterday why. Because what they do is they'll do the service and it could probably be done in an hour, maybe an hour and a half max. But they do Greek and English, Greek and English, Greek and English for the, you know, the older parishioners like the Greek and the younger parishioners like the the English.
Yesterday was the Passion Gospel.
Yes.
Do you know how long it was?
How long?
13 minutes.
Oh.
Yeah, well, it's about, what, 6 pages now?
Yeah.
That's a dream.
13 minutes. I timed it.
That's a dream.
My phone in church.
That's how long it takes us to greet each other in the first part of the church and light the candle and say hello to everybody, and then you go sit down.
There was this probably a 3 or 4 year old girl in front of me that kept taking her palms and putting it in my face. She thought it was funny. Like, tickle my nose. I'm like, okay, enough. All right, Dad.
Pete, did they let you sit down during the Passion? They let us sit down this time.
Some people sat. I chose to stand.
Our priest said to sit down.
Hmm.
Kind of ordered us to sit down. Usually you're supposed to stand during the whole thing, but he told us to sit down.
There's a lot of up-down in our church. Do you guys have that too?
Oh, yeah.
Stances.
Up and down.
Yeah, it's a little ding-ding.
1 year, Bill Curtis was the voice of Jesus at Old St. Pat's during the Passion.
Which makes sense.
Right.
I mean, you think
I'm sorry I missed
voice
that.
Voice of God, right?
Yes, the voice of God, Bill Curtis.
Yes.
All right, Bill and Wendy coming in next at 720 WGN.